I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation about racial tension on college campuses, following last month's stabbing death of a black Bowie State University student by a white University of Maryland student with ties to an online white supremacist group. The problem of bigotry at universities is widespread. Lawrence Ross is the author of Blackball, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He joins me along with two student activists. Ashley Vasquez studies at the University of Maryland. She's a member of Protect UMD, a coalition that represents several minority communities at College Park. Matt Brown is a recent Johns Hopkins University graduate. While in school, he organized a protest to address racial bias on that campus. Midday gets underway right after these headlines.
You are listening to Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. Now, on with Midday.
And good afternoon. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us. At this hour, at Memorial Chapel on the campus of the University of Maryland, College Park, an interfaith service is being held to remember Richard Collins III. The bus stop in front of Montgomery Hall on the College Park campus also continues to be a place where Collins is remembered with flowers and poems and expressions of grief. An African-American ROTC student at Bowie State University. Last month, standing at that bus stop, Richard Collins was brutally murdered just days after receiving a commission as a second lieutenant in the Army. His alleged killer, Sean Urbanski, is a white University of Maryland student with ties to an online hate group which calls itself Alt-Reich. This group posted bigoted memes and messages about people of color. While Urbanski has not been charged with a hate crime, students of color at the university say Collins' death is not an isolated incident and that the racial climate on campus is fraught with bias and bigotry. In early May, for example, a noose was found hanging in a University of Maryland frat house. And College Park is by no means the only American college campus battling bigotry. Last month, bananas hung by nooses were found at American University in Washington, D.C. Harvard, Columbia, Dartmouth, and universities across the country have reported dozens of incidents of bias in recent months. Some scholars have observed that racism on predominantly white college campuses is as old as the universities themselves. Today, a conversation about racial tension in higher education. We hope to be joined soon by Lawrence Ross. He's the author of several books. His latest is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campus. Ashley Vasquez is here with me in Studio A. She's a rising senior studying sociology at the University of Maryland. She's a member of the Student Government Association and the Delta Sigma Theta sorority. Ashley serves as the president of the school's National Pan-Hellenic Council chapter. She's also a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of 25 student organizations representing eight minority communities at the University of Maryland. Ashley, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Of course. It's good to be here.
And Matt Brown joins us on the line from his home in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Matt graduated from Johns Hopkins University last month with a degree in public health. And while at Johns Hopkins, he was a member of the Student Government Association, and he held several leadership positions within the Black Student Union. In 2015, as president of the BSU, he organized a protest to address issues of discrimination and bias on campus. Matt Brown, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
And we are joined now by Lawrence Ross. As I mentioned, he's the author of several books. His latest is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Mr. Ross, thank you so much. You're joining us from WVTF Radio over in Roanoke, Virginia. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
For folks who are listening online, or rather listening on the radio, you are welcome to give us a call and join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Of course, if you are listening online, you're welcome to call. If you're listening on a podcast, that probably isn't going to work out so well. But Lawrence Ross, let me start with you. you know, we're told, and we've been told for almost 10 years now, really since the election of Barack Obama as the president, that the younger generation in particular, the generation that is in college and coming of age during the time of Mr. Obama's election, is much less bigoted, that racial harmony was right around the corner. There's lots more interracial dating. There's interracial marriage. There's just the biases and bigotries that were held by this generation's parents were not going to be held, certainly, in as complete a way by the generation of young people coming up now, particularly in universities, this place where everybody's enlightened and everybody's educated and, you know, pursuing their education. But your book paints a very different picture of American college campuses. What's wrong with the narrative that says, you know, there were even people in 2008 who trotted out the term post-racial to describe America?
America tends to love to look at college campuses as being as what I call educational Disneylands, where, you know, we have free speech land over there and critical thinking land over there and passed out drunk land, but nobody remembers what happens over there. But, you know, what typically happens is that we don't really realize is that I don't care if your kid is 18 to 21 on the college campus, they're still coming from the United States, they're still coming from America. And we make a mistake oftentimes when we think about, you know, we want to talk about things like being post-racial, which I never bought into in the first place. But we want to make these kind of pronouncements due to the fact that our interpersonal relationships might be a lot closer than, say, for example, what happened in society in the 1950s and 1960s, and then think that the underlying white supremacist foundation of this country in terms of, you know, what creates the systemic and institutional racism has suddenly changed. Now, look, it's not. I'm not here to say that, you know, being on the campus of University of Alabama in 1960 is the same as 2017. That's not what I'm saying. But we too often put upon the millennials, or in my case, the Gen Xers, or each succeeding younger generation, this idea that because we are more integrated in terms of everything that we do in terms of society, that suddenly the views and the viewpoints that of, you know, that support white supremacy or systemic racism or individual racism have gone away. Not necessarily at all. One of the things I found when I was researching Blackball was that it didn't really matter whether or not you had a conservative or a liberal president in the office. It didn't matter whether or not there was a Democrat or a Republican. You'd see spikes, for example. We see spikes in terms of with President Trump. Spikes in the amount of hate crimes, but you never saw them disappear during the Obama administration. You never saw them disappear during the Nixon and the Carter administrations. They were always there. They're pretty much as consistent on college campuses as cheerleaders at a college football game. But what we'd like to see when we look at our you know, universities and college and universities is this idea that the students on those campuses represent our future. So no one wants to look at the future and think to ourselves, well, you know, they still actually represent the past, because they're coming from, oftentimes in particular for these students, they're coming from segregated America. 80% of Latino students coming on college campuses come from segregated K-12 schools. 74% of African Americans come from segregated K-12 schools, which means, of course, on the contrary, that white students are coming from predominantly 80 to 85% segregated schools. So we can't be surprised that, you know, that the social structures on college campuses, such as fraternity, you know, predominantly white fraternities and sororities, tend to reinforce the negative racial stereotypes that they have. Now, the problem, I actually spoke at the University of Maryland last year and talked about some of the issues that were going on at the University of Maryland. I am not surprised by the fact that the rhetoric, and I think we need to be very, very careful to not just make the young man who killed the young Bowie State student into a subset, you know, because he was a member of an alt-right group that we say, oh, well, he's a subset of a group of white students. No, he was a University of Maryland student, and he was the only thing that he did differently than a lot of the students on college campuses around this country is that he acted in violence. And we see basically a canary in the coal mine when we see these incidents, whether or not it's rhetoric that is we can be termed as hate speech, or as we see demonstrative actions on college campuses amongst white students against minorities in order to intimidate and threaten them on a regular basis. And too often what we do, and I always tell people, I went to the University of California, Berkeley, the home of free speech. I love free speech. But one of the problems is that when we think of free speech as being simply just some sort of holy grail that, you know, doesn't have repercussions, it has repercussions. And it has repercussions in terms of the consequences or lack of accountability that comes from some of that speech that sometimes can end up and act out in terms of violence, or just the idea that minority students on college campuses don't feel welcome on those college campuses.
Lawrence Ross, his latest book is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're talking about racial tension at universities across the country. Ashley Vasquez, you're with me here in the studio. I understand that when you just finished your junior year. When you all came back to campus after Christmas break, there were posters all over campus recruiting people to join a hate group. Tell us what that was about. What was your experience with that?
So when we came back from winter break, the beginning of the spring 2017 semester, there were white supremacist posters posted all over academic buildings, asking students to join these white supremacy groups, asking students to stand up for white supremacy groups, to call the number listed on the poster, and basically speak out against the minorities on the campus, say that they weren't welcomed. And the university did nothing about it. As Protect UMD, we made the posters very known to our campus.
And Protect UMD is this coalition of student groups on campus. Just
yes,
to remind folks of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Protect UMD is a coalition of over 25 different student groups on campus, and we displayed the posters on social media to let people know that they were there and that the university did nothing about them. And for us, we've known that we've had white supremacists on our campus. That's not a surprise. It's, nothing new. But to see them, finally take another step and really put themselves out there was more fearful for us as minorities on campus because things were progressing more than we thought they should.
We did get a statement from Daniel Falvey. He's the chair of the University Senate, and Michelle Eastman, the assistant president and chief of staff at the University of Maryland, who say that today marks 1 month since the senseless murder of Second Lieutenant Richard Collins III. Our thoughts are with his family, friends, and Bowie State community as they grieve for him. As our community reflects and mourns our efforts to continue to fight hate and create a safer campus together, as President Lowe, that's Wallace Lowe, he's the president of the University of Maryland, has said, quote, united by this recent tragedy, we can be a force for good. Together, we can be stronger and smarter than those who would divide us and subvert the values that undergird our university and our democracy. He goes on to talk about important initial steps that have already been taken. Ashley Vasquez, what's your response to the steps that the university put into place as they responded to this horrible murder of Mr. Collins?
Well, obviously, my first thought is these steps came in too late, is my initial thought. I'm not saying that the death could have been prevented, but I'm saying that the university for so long ignored the blatant racism and ignorance on our campus that unfortunately led to this senseless murder. The action points that President Lowe and the university came out with are initial steps, but those steps won't really create change, in my belief. On those initial steps, the university needs to establish a clear definition of hate crime, of what is a hate bias on our campus. On top of that, if a hate crime was to occur on our campus, there needs to be a campus-wide assessment of how the students are feeling, how the faculty and staff are feeling. As you know, a noose was found in late April. To this day, the university still has not alerted the students or staff or faculty on our campus. Things like that cannot continue to happen. As well as on these initial steps, we need to properly fund our Title IX office. The Title IX office of the University of Maryland is the Office of Civil Rights and Sexual Misconduct. This is where students can go to report hate crimes or sexual misconduct, and the office is understaffed, it's underfunded. We can't have an office that's understaffed and underfunded and then wonder why students aren't going there to report.
Sure. And Matt Brown, you've just graduated from Hopkins last month. Congratulations. I understand
Thank you very much. You're studying
to put yourself into medical school next year. Tell us about your experience as president of the Black Student Union at Hopkins when incidents of racial bias happen on the campus of Hopkins. What has been the university's response, and do you think that that response has been adequate?
I found it's been very mixed and unfortunately on the more negative side of reactions and how the university acts. Right before I became president, there's this one app that's very popular, it used to be very popular on campus called Yik Yak, where essentially people in a certain geographic range, and it tells you how far away they are from wherever you are, can post anonymously. And so what we found was that all of a sudden people within the Hopkins students' living range, about 1 mile or less away, were posting things about, you know, Black people saying, you know, I don't get why they're burning down the city. And this was during the Baltimore uprising. I don't get why the apes got out of the zoo. The only place I want to see a Black person is hanging from a tree. They need to get back to picking cotton. And we were all appalled because, you know, unfortunately, we've seen incidents where these hate speeches can turn into a violent act, and we don't want that. We brought this to the administration's attention, and they looked at it, and they were horrified, and we were all like, okay, great, they're going to actually do something. But then the whole issue was they said, oh, this is, you know, free speech and we can't really do anything about it unless something happens. And also it's anonymous. But they also had the technology and admitted to go find out who these students were. And it put us in a very uncomfortable position because we were saying, you know, if you have the ability to go after these students and show them that this is not okay to be throwing threatening speeches around and, you know, basically threatening the lives of students on campus, why won't you do something about it? I've also had protests on campus, especially right before Thanksgiving break, my junior year, and the university listened to us. They heard our list of demands, and they decided to come to the forum that we held, which was the Black Student Forum. And I think it was very well attended, about 500, 600 people of all races and you know, backgrounds, staff, students, alum. And after that, they put out the Roadmap to Diversity, which I think is a very poorly done document, especially when it was first started. It's supposed to be a working document to how to fix some of these issues that Black students have brought to the attention, but they'd left out certain things that they didn't give us a timeline or a budgetary amount for each action they were trying to take with the barely few amount of concrete actions they put out there. And they also didn't even use the word racism or racist acts or hate crime within the whole document, which kind of concerned us that this was supposed to be tackling racism on campus, but they wouldn't even use the word in the document.
But that document, of course, as you mentioned, continues to develop. We do not have a statement from Hopkins. We were not able to reach out to them and get a statement from them as we did from the University of Maryland. We're going to take a quick break now. Matt Brown graduated from Johns Hopkins last month. He has a degree now in public health. And while at Hopkins, he was a member of the SGA, and he served as the president of the Black Student Union. He joins us on the phone. Ashley Vasquez studies sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. She's also a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of 25 student organizations that represent 8 minority communities at the university. And Lawrence Ross joins us as well. His latest book is Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, E.J. Dion joins me for a recap of the special congressional elections that are being held today in Georgia and South Carolina. If newcomer John Ossoff manages to beat a Republican candidate in a traditionally Republican district in Georgia, will this portend gains for Democrats in Congress in 2018? Lots of folks keeping an eye on that, and we will do the same tomorrow here on the program. Plus, NPR science reporter Richard Harris joins me to talk about his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. That's a mouthful for a title. He'll explain how a lot of the medical and scientific studies that make it into prestigious journals are not reproducible, and that calls their validity into question. So we've got E.J. Dion and NPR's Richard Harris tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about racial tension on college campuses. Lawrence Ross wrote about this in his book, Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He joins us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. Matt Brown just graduated from Johns Hopkins University. He was the president of the Black Student Union and a member of the Hopkins Student Government Association. In 2015, he organized a protest that sparked forums on race and bias and eventually led to the university's roadmap on diversity and inclusion. He joins us on the line from his home in New Jersey. And Ashley Vasquez is here with me in Studio A. She's a rising senior. She's studying sociology at the University of Maryland. She's a member of Protect UMD. That's a coalition of organizations that represent minority communities at the university. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @Midday. Tom Hall. Lawrence Ross, one of your other books was about the history of fraternities and sororities, particularly Black fraternities and sororities. But when it comes to white fraternities and sororities, a lot of the racial bias incidents that we're seeing across the country do emanate from these fraternities in particular. What's the connection between these organizations and this clear uptick in racial insensitivity that we're seeing on college campuses?
Yeah, my first book is actually The Divine Nine: History of African American Fraternities and Sororities. And as a result, I've studied pretty much all the different fraternities and sororities. And the history of predominantly white fraternities and sororities tend to be set around race. We get into the early part of the 20th century, and as college campuses became more plural, you begin to see racial covenants within the constitutions of pretty about 90% of the predominantly white fraternities and sororities. And they fought really hard all the way through the 1950s and 1960s in order to keep most of their organizations predominantly white. Now, through the last 30 years or so, they've been making some efforts to diversify, and you can see within the organizations that there's a bit of diversity. But the problem is that like when we talk about how America is, we talk about the foundation of the organizations, the roots of these organizations keep perpetuating the exact same racial incidents that we see happening in 2017 the same way that happened in 1950s. In Blackballed, I talk about the fact that the idea of exclusion or Black people and Latino people and Asians as the other is something that is predominant within these organizations. So you see a lot of the symbolism of white supremacy all the time, the combination of nooses, the use of the Confederate flag as a white supremacist symbol, the use of blackface, which is almost an epidemic amongst fraternities and sororities, white fraternities and sororities, happens every single year during Halloween, Black History Month, Martin Luther King's birthday, and then during Cinco de Mayo when it comes to Latinos. There's this culture within predominantly white fraternities and sororities that says that the denigration of minorities, those people who you did not grow up with, those people who are the other, is something that is fair game. But what's strange is that there's a cognitive dissonance between when they get caught in terms of them thinking themselves as being racist. I remember there was one young woman named Paige Schumacher at Kansas State who was, had a black face on and had a racial epithet in a Snapchat video and a Snapchat picture. And when they interviewed her after she had gotten caught, she said, "I am the least racist person that you could possibly meet. And no way would I make this derogatory." And I thought to myself, if you're the least racist person, who is the most? And oftentimes what happens is that that's a common thought, because for a lot of these students, racism is something that bad people do over there, the people that they can label, particularly when we talk about white students looking at other white students. You can label a redneck, quote unquote, as a racist, or you can label this ignorant person over here as a racist. But I can't possibly be a racist because I'm a good person. Now, there's a moralistic tie to racism. But that's the problem. For a lot of these students, they don't understand this, that they're playing right into white supremacy every act they do that is centered around a racial something denigrating to a racial minority on campus. And that also ties into why the universities tend to not have a good response to racial incidents. They play whack-a-mole. Inside Higher Education did a study in 2015 and 2016. They asked 700 different college presidents, what is the racial climate on – how would you judge the racial climate on your college campus? And in 2015, 90% of the 700 college presidents said it was either good or excellent. All right. Then after that, we had about 150 different campus racism incidents and protests. So they came back in 2016 and asked them. They said, "Well, you know, what do you think right now?" The it was still 90%, but the number of presidents that said excellent actually went up. So that tells you that there's a disconnect between how the administration actually sees their campuses in terms of this utopian space versus the realities of what students of color have to deal with on these college campuses. And too often what happens is that people discount it because they think to themselves, well, you're a college student, so therefore by definition you're kind of part of an elite, so why are you complaining? It's, you know, completely different than, say, for example, this type of racism, which I consider to be legit. Well, no, racism in any form is racism. And if you're trying to create an atmosphere where, if I'm a college student, that you're trying your best in some way to make it harder for me to get a degree, then what you're trying to do is you're making it harder for me as a person who's getting a degree and trying to help transform America. You're making it harder for me to transform this society.
You know, you're interested. One of the points you make in your book about these white fraternities, you say that only 2% of the U.S. population is involved in fraternities. However, 76% of senators and congressmen, 85% of the U.S. Supreme Court, 80% of Fortune 500 executives, and all but two presidents belong to fraternities. So if you're excluded from those fraternities and those organizations, your networking and all the stuff that's supposed to happen while you're in college, you know, those opportunities certainly diminish. I mean, Ashley Vasquez, I guess it was your freshman year, it was 2014, a white fraternity sent out an email for a Martin Luther King Day party saying only to invite women of color because they are easier on MLK Day. The university was informed about the email. You say that they took no action. You're not very optimistic about the university's capacity as an institution to counter these trends on campus. What is the solution? What do you think Dr. Lowe, as the president of the university, and the staff and faculty can do, keeping in mind that they do have to balance the First Amendment and issues of freedom of speech? What can they do to counter what's going on in your campus?
So in keeping in mind free speech, I mean, the first thing you still have to do is condemn words of hate against students that you're supposed to keep safe. We're a university that prides itself on diversity and inclusion, yet those students who are supposed to be your diversity and inclusion aren't protected, don't feel safe, you know, fear walking on campus. The email that was sent out was discovered a year later through screenshots that were posted on social media. The Department of Fraternity and Sorority Life did nothing. You know, they knew the name of the person who sent the email. They knew the fraternity of which he belonged to, and they still did nothing. The university, on top of that, did nothing. And the steps that they have to take, keeping in mind, you know, free speech, again, is condemning those words.
Yeah,
and
so, of course, they would say that they're doing a lot more than nothing. I mean,
oh, you know, yeah,
Mr.
of course.
Dr. Lowe is saying, you know, we've got these 5-point plan to do things as an initial step. We're talking about rapid response teams for hate bias incidents, talking about having students sign a pledge for, you know, being tolerant and unbigoted. But you're shaking your head. You're saying that ain't happening. But what should they be doing? I mean, I think Dr. Lowe would say, well, yes, I do condemn hate speech. He would be the first to say, I don't condone it in the least.
Oh, of course, and I'm not saying that he does condone it, but he waits to condone. He waits to condemn it. He waits until it's too late, until, you know, he needs to condemn it in front of the media or in front of the entire university. We had chalkings that said deport dreamers that were written when we came back from winter break across campus. We had student activists go and cross out these deport dreamer chalkings. And President Lowe, he quoted the tweet on Twitter with that picture and said, look at my students having this wonderful conversation, right? As if that was a conversation that we wanted to have, you know, deporting dreamers. That's not something that we support. So as a president,
so it's the nature of his rhetoric and the timeliness of his rhetoric that
more so,
you. Yeah.
More so, because the timeliness is always when, you know, it's too late at this point. And as we saw, you know, unfortunately in May, it was too late and Lieutenant Collins lost his life because we've waited and waited time again to not answer anything. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's promoted a nature on our campus that we accept racism, which we don't.
And Matt Brown, your experience at Hopkins grew, as you mentioned, in part out of the uprising that happened here in Baltimore in 2015 following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. And you also led protests a couple of years ago that started out to be in solidarity with places like University of Missouri and Yale and other places that were protesting incidences of racial bias, or in the case of Yale, the naming of one of their dorms or colleges there. This is a national dilemma. I mean, we just have an incidence of Harvard University denying admission now, you know, rescinding the offer of admission to 10 students for postings that they put on a private Facebook page that were bigoted and misogynist and anti-Semitic and racist. What's your take about what universities as institutions can do to counter this?
Well, first, I think that it's important to realize that we need to stress how universities shouldn't stand for this. And I think one way to do that is during orientation. You know, you have a lot of different events that the freshmen go to. They can be fun things like, you know, how to make friends, what's the best way to study. But at our school, I know one thing that I've always liked is how they've recently implemented sexual assault training and bystander intervention training during orientation. So all freshmen have to go through it, and they have to sit there and really understand what it means to, you know, look out for someone who might be in a potentially unsafe environment. And I think what we should be doing in regards to free speech and hate speech is having the same sort of training during orientation. You know, having a session where students have to sit there and they have to really think about, okay, we break down what's the difference between what's free speech and what does that look like, and what does hate speech look like, and how do people try to say that hate speech is free speech and why we can't tolerate that. It can't be something where we have an incident and then we respond, because at that point it's too late. The incident's already occurred. We need freshmen to come in their freshman year, and that first we already get the mentality in their head that the university will not tolerate any sort of hate speech against another person on this campus. We need to think of everyone as a unit, and as a university as a unit, and that if one person is hurting the unit, we need to take care of them and prevent any further harm to them, and not have this sort of retroactive way of dealing with incidents.
Let's go to the phones. Matthew in Owings Mills, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I just had a thought, which is, and it's a matter of priorities, which is, I think that the place where racism is both most dangerous and most deeply in place and operates with the most impunity is in the campus police. I mean, after all, these are people who have the power of the state behind them. They carry guns. And I haven't heard a whole bunch of discussion on this show about the racism in law enforcement of in terms of campus law enforcement. Because, hate speech is awful. It can chase a person off campus. It can interfere with their studies. But the campus police can make you dead.
Lawrence Ross, your experience as you study this about the role of campus police, I mean, are their problems reflective of the problems of distrust among communities of color that law enforcement in general have?
Well, I think, you know, you could just extrapolate from, you know, law enforcement in general in this country. But ironically, I love that question, because it kind of speaks to kind of the innocence that we provide over, like, the common student who walks, you know, particularly the common white student who comes on a campus, the thought that there must be another nefarious element. And for example, I go to LSU, for example. LSU had a spate of students calling the police on African-American men walking home from the library late at night, to the point where the police had to, you know, because it would come via an app. The police actually had to say to the students, stop reporting these students who are coming from the library. So if what the caller was saying, and it's a legitimate place to do some study and to see whether or not there's some issues. But what he was doing is he was doing the exact same thing that we tend to see with white students, is that they look at, there has to be some other entity other than me. Other than me, who's a good person, who grew up in a great place, who's a smart kid, who came on campus, and I can't possibly be the actual root of the issues dealing with racism on campus. It's easier to then point to an institution like the police, because then we can say, hey, you know, we have all this long legacy of stuff. It's got to be really coming from them. No, It's coming from all those sweet, nice little kids who end up on a college campus and have no problem every single year deciding to put blackface or, you know, have a noose around their neck or doing a number of things. That is the most consensus. I cannot even tell you how consistent it is. It never, ever stops for these kids. The only problem is that people, as Ashley was talking about, there's just a whack-a-mole type of response. Sean Harper, who used to be at the University of Pennsylvania and he's now at the University of Southern California, did a study on the response from college presidents to racist incidents. And they found that their concerns were more about public relations for the university versus an actual solution. So it's easy to put out a five-point, and I think this is Ashley's frustration as a student. It's easy to put out a five-point plan versus saying, okay, you know what we're going to do? In terms of a structure for the university, what we're going to do is we're going to make a mandatory requirement in terms of one particular diversity track. It doesn't matter whether or not you're an engineer or whether or not you're in sociology. You're going to go into a diversity track in order to graduate, which means that it hits at the fundamental part about what it means to be on campus. And that means that you're doing fundamental changes, not waiting until the kid who comes on campus and doesn't think that there's anything wrong with, denigrating Latinos because he's, you know, mimicking some speech or he just decides that I can hide behind some sort of political thought, but hide behind the political thought as a way to actually denigrate human beings versus saying you have to go into this particular area due to the fact we're trying to not only graduate people who get jobs, but people who actually make changes in this world.
Got to take a break. Lawrence Ross is a writer and frequent contributor to TheRoot.com. His latest book is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Ashley Vasquez studies sociology at the University of Maryland. She's a member of Delta Sigma Theta, and she serves as the president of the school's National Pan-Hellenic Council chapter. She's also a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of organizations that represent minority communities at College Park. Matt Brown's on the line from New Jersey, where he's studying for his MCATs. He's a recent Johns Hopkins University graduate, and he studied public health at Hopkins. He was a class senator in the SGA and served as the president of the Black Student Union. We'll have more on racial bias on college campuses. 410-662-8780. When we come back from a break, you can email us midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Got a bunch of folks on the line trying to get on the show. I will do my best after these 90 seconds.
This is your NPR News Station. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the extremely unsettling uptick in racially motivated incidents of intolerance and sometimes violence on American college campuses. Lawrence Ross joins us from a radio station in Virginia. Lawrence Ross is the author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He's also a contributor to TheRoot.com. Matt Brown graduated from Johns Hopkins last month with a degree in public health. He was a member of the Student Government Association and the president of the Black Student Union. And Ashley Vasquez is here with me in Studio A. She's a rising senior on her way to real life in just a few months. She's studying sociology at the University of Maryland College Park. She's a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of student organizations that represent minority communities on the College Park campus. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Ashley Vasquez, you led a protest or were involved in a protest about the fact that campus police at University of Maryland do carry guns. The university has said that it is a federal law that when there are programs like there is one at University of Maryland in nuclear engineering, because there's nuclear materials, there have to be a certain number of firearms issued to campus police. But you had a direct experience with campus police just last spring. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so last spring, in the spring of 2016, there was a graduation party to celebrate the recent graduates. This party was predominantly, it was all minority students, and the police got a fake call about someone who couldn't get in the party, and police came, knocked on the door. They knocked so hard, they left basically a hole in the door. We all left the party, and the police started pepper spraying us and arresting many students.
What were they alleging? What were the police alleging that the students were doing?
Well, at first, the police were alleging that we were beating people inside. And we were really confused because there was no alcohol at the party. There was no drugs at the party. It was just students listening to music. And afterwards...
Where do you think they heard that report? Or where do you think they got that impression that there was violence going on inside the party?
There was a student or a visitor who couldn't get into the party. So he called the police, you know, making this accusation. So the police came full force to the party. So they started pepper spraying us, arresting us. And I mean, I was there and it was really a gruesome scene from a horror movie. You know, people were screaming. It sounded like people were dying. And my next fear was that somebody was going to get shot, you know? And we actually had to call 911 to alert the Prince George's County Police to send more units out to help them control the university police because they were getting out of hand. And the people being arrested, I think there was one male arrested, but the only people that were arrested were all females, you know, very small women. And the police said that they feared for their lives because of us. And the university police ended up saying that they were using an excessive use of force. And one of the officers who started initially pepper spraying people was suspended for 2 weeks with pay and is back on the force. And they started implementing these diversity trainings. It's been over a year and these diversity trainings still haven't been completely implemented.
So they are doing diversity trainings. I mean, it sounds like this is a horrific incident here, but there are diversity trainings for the campus police. And President Lowe is also suggesting diversity training for faculty and for the student body in general. Again, it's such a conundrum as to what institutions can do. Let's try to sneak in a couple of phone calls. Mary in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thank you for your call.
Hi. My name is Mary Owens. I'm a high school teacher at Bladensburg High School for 17 years.
That's in Prince George's County, right?
Prince George's County, yeah. I've lived in Baltimore for 30 years. So, I was an anthropology student at Maryland in the early 80s. And, you know, I feel listening to all this, like, we're talking about behavior in this young population. I look at college kids as kids, you know, and I'm with kids all the time. I'm with teenagers. And I'm watching what they make of racism writ large, you know, and how they interact. And, you know, a lot of them, they love comedy stuff on their phones where they love the racial and ethnic jokes and all that, you know, that's the lighter side of it. But also just divisions within our school. And I feel like similarly, schools are flat-footed in dealing with what goes down between the kids. Just like, I feel like, you know, the whack-a-mole comment about campus authorities and, I feel like we need to get into understanding the groups and their interactions and what, you know, because these kids are, they ate what we fed them. They're taking in the adult world of what they see as racism. And kids are goofy and unscrupulous and latch on to stupid ideas and feel egotistical. I feel like, you know, there needs to be a group level, you know, like getting these kids to talk to each other, like, we have to do in a high school. You know, we have a 70% immigrant population at Bladensburg and like 30% African-American, maybe 10 white kids. It used to be 70% African-American and 30% immigrant. So we've gone through a huge change demographically with...
Yeah, well, thanks for the call, Mary. And Lawrence Ross, I mean, Mary brings up a big point. We, you know, students do eat what we feed them. What's your take about what a high school can do, what a university can do? For example, in the example of Harvard, who found out that these 10 students that they had accepted into their school had posted these misogynist, racist things, anti-Semitic things online, and they bounced them. They said, nope, you're not coming. We don't want you part of the community. Is that the appropriate response? Is there something that can be done for students who are already enrolled? What do you think?
There is no, you don't have a divine right to go to Harvard. I mean, I think the acceptance rate at Harvard is around between 3 to 5%. And then you get into Harvard and you decide that's what you want to do. Well, you know, Harvard has the right to say, well, you don't belong to the family. You don't belong to what it means to be a member of the Harvard family. And remember, that's what colleges and universities try to, you know, to market themselves as being part of, you know, the Golden Bear family, the Terrapin family, so on and so forth. You're not just, you know, walking in and just, you know, saying I'm just being by myself. You are part of the family. And if your values don't match that, well, then okay, maybe somewhere else is better. But I want to get back to the high school teacher in terms of what she said. Yes, they eat what we feed, you know, what we feed them. But at the same time, you also have to come to the realization, this is what people don't want to do. What is the foundational issues that when you walk into a college, university, or high school that actually creates this notion that of you know, based upon the foundation of white supremacy, that the sexist, that systemic and individual racism is acceptable. It is not just simply that I teach a person something on a one-on-one basis or my family teaches them. They grow up in a community understanding that this is something that they have and other people don't. That's the hard part. And that I'm pretty sure most of your callers are going to not want to really want to deal with the fundamental structural issues we'll have to take. Because really, the systemic and individual racist that we see, that's just a tumor. The white supremacist foundation is the cancer that we have to try to uproot. And when you keep asking about what can universities do, you have to get at the foundation.
And let me ask both Matt and Ashley, and you for that matter, Lawrence Ross, are any of you aware of students, individual students, who are identified as the perpetrators of hate speech or anti-racial behavior on campus, who have been kicked out of the university, who have been told that they are no longer allowed to be members of the family? There's incidents at Harvard, you know, they hadn't quite started yet, but they had been accepted. But that does happen, Lawrence Ross, doesn't it?
Yeah, University of Oklahoma, Sigma Alpha Epsilon members, Levi Pettit, and another young man whose name escapes me right now, they were caught on camera singing about lynching African Americans from a tree. Well, except they didn't use the word African Americans. David Boren, the president of University of Oklahoma, kicked them out. But that's not really just the full story. You have to remember that 2 months prior to them being caught on camera and being a national embarrassment for the University of Oklahoma, the black students had gotten together with the administration and said, "We don't feel part of the family." So it was beyond just the incident right there. The students, the African American students, were saying that this university may be diverse, but it doesn't make us feel included.
And Matt Brown, what's your experience? I mean, when it comes to incidents of hate crimes and stuff, Ashley brought up the sometimes ambiguity about what constitutes a hate crime. Was that an issue at Hopkins when you were there as a student?
I find that was the same thing as well. I think students sometimes have a distrust of bringing forth issues that they view as a hate crime because they, A, aren't really educated about what that might look like when we first come through orientation. But there's also the issue of we haven't seen any real incidents besides one incident with the teacher that I know of someone being removed or punished for a hate crime. I actually dealt with, as an RA, I was going up to check on a student, and I dealt with some racial remarks then, and the best I got out of that student was just a letter apologizing, which was very poorly written and clearly showed a lack of care for what has happened. And so I can't really think, even besides myself, of anyone who's ever brought forth a hate crime and seen success with going through the process, which I find really unfortunate.
Let's try to sneak in one more quick phone call. John in White Marsh, welcome to the show. We've got about 30 seconds before we're going to have to wrap it up. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air. Let's go real quick. What's
Hi
on
there.
Your mind?
First of all, Ashley, as a former University of Maryland student myself, I'm so sorry that your college experience was not the same as mine. My question kind of touched on what Lawrence was just talking about. Are those punishments enough to change the behaviors of the individual? Is being kicked out of Harvard going to make that individual stop being racist?
Now, Lawrence Ross, let's give you the last word. I mean, how does one, in fact, change the heart and mind of a racist? This is a question that has, you know, been a conundrum for a long time.
I'm not necessarily sure that that's our goal. I mean, in terms of at Harvard, the kids who are not going to Harvard right now may learn something. They may become resolved. I don't care. If I'm going to Harvard, my thing is that I just don't want them on campus. And that's different than having a different point of view. If you have a different contrarian point of view than me, that's fine. We can discuss that. But I don't want a – just in the same way, I don't want a misogynist person on a campus. That is Harvard's mission, to have a university, a college that actually helps train some of the greatest leaders for America that's going to for the future. But changing their minds, I'm not invested in that.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I appreciate all three of you joining us this afternoon for this very important discussion. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Ross is the author of several books, including The Divine Nine, The History of African-American Fraternities and Sororities. His latest book is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He's also a contributor to TheRoot.com. Ashley Vasquez is a rising senior studying sociology at the University of Maryland and a member of Protect UMD. That's a coalition that represents minority communities at College Park. Matt Brown graduated from Hopkins last month with his degree in public health. And while at Hopkins, he was a member of the SGA and served as the president of the Black Student Union. We'll have more information on the web, WYPR.org/midday. Coming up tomorrow on the program, I'll speak with award-winning NPR science reporter Richard Harris about his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. That's a cheery title, which speaks volumes. We'll examine just how reliable many scientific studies are. And we'll also talk to E.J. Dion about the special elections in Georgia and South Carolina. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening to Midday. Have a great day.